It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we'll talk to a media expert about how the new merger between the company that owns the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and a media company in Cincinnati will change Milwaukee's media landscape.
But first, an annual summer camp aims to encourage young girls to consider careers in the protective services.
It's called Camp Hero. It offers girls the chance to have hands-on experience testing out the jobs of police officers, firefighters, EMTs, and dispatchers in a safe environment. Jen Roman is a captain at the City of Madison Fire Department, and she's the founder of Camp Hero. She joins us here in the studio to talk about it. Welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So why did you want to design a camp specifically to get girls trying out these lines of work?
Yeah, the short answer is there are very few women in the protective services. We see about 35% nationwide in EMS, 12% in police, and only 3.4% in firefighting. And it's because girls don't think of that as a possibility for themselves. So we thought we'd do something about it.
And when you're teaching these things to girls and giving them this hands-on experience, do you see that kind of cracking? I mean, you might the little boys want to be firefighters, the little girls maybe not. Are you changing that? Are you moving the needle?
Yeah, absolutely. I tell a story about when I was out doing inspections one day with a fire truck, and we pulled up by a school playground. The kids ran up to the fence and I chatted with them, and the little boys, when I asked them, what do you want to be when you grow up, the little boys answered right away, policeman, and I want to be a superhero. And the girls waited until I pointed to them, and I got dancer and hairdresser. And when I suggested, how about a firefighter like me, it was though I was speaking an alien. They had never even considered that for themselves. So our intention with Camp Hero is to introduce the idea to girls, and then with the older girls to actually give them experience so that they can build the confidence that they need to approach it either as a volunteer or paid person.
Well, speaking of the superheroes the boys mentioned, they all have an origin story. What's your origin story? What got you to want to go into a firefighting career?
Yeah, you know, I think I've always wanted to be in a helper profession. I have early recollections of wanting to do that. But my career really started as an EMT, a volunteer EMT, first with Shorewood and then out with Deer Grove EMS. And I went on to paramedic school and started looking for a job. And at the time, the only place that was hiring was Madison Fire Department. So as I went through the process, I was both excited and petrified that I would get hired because I really didn't know anything about firefighting at the time. But it was the means for me to work in what I really love to do, which is taking care of people in the ambulance.
Well, now, working at the camp, you're, in a sense, a role model for the girls there. Was there anybody like that for you when you were going into this profession?
There are many women like that for me as I rolled into this profession, but also men. One person in particular, he was my lieutenant when I first came on the job, and he's a chief now, Chief Schwen, decided to tuck me under his wing and to show me the ropes and really take care of me.
Now, looking at the grown-ups now, before we get back to specifically what you're doing with the kids, you mentioned the national numbers, the percentages of women in these professions, the protective service professions. Are there places that are doing well? You mentioned Madison. What is Madison doing in terms of numbers, and are there things that are being done differently here?
Madison is actually doing quite well. So our police department has about 35% women, which is incredible. Our fire department has 11% firefighters. And, you know, to hear 11%, you think that's a very low number, but it's actually high compared to the rest of the country. New York City still has less than 1% females on their firefighting force. So we've had somewhat successful recruitment in the city of Madison. Certainly we've had good retention, but there's still a lot of work to be done.
And, you know, you mentioned national numbers, we mentioned Madison. How about the state as a whole? I don't know if anybody's tracking statewide percentages. Do you have a sense of where that ranges?
I will say that Madison is an island and that we're well ahead of other places in the state. There are still many fire departments who have never had a female firefighter.
Is there something that we lose by not having women in these lines of work?
I think so. I think in order to serve our communities well, that we need to have demographics in our workforce that match our population. Women have a different perspective. We certainly can do the job, though it is a common belief that we can't.
Is that a belief around the country among the men already in these lines of work?
Men and women. We're enculturated from a very young age to believe that girls can do certain things and boys can do certain things. The gender bias goes both ways, but we certainly feel it and see it in firefighting.
Well, let's go to camp now. You've been working with kids. What's the age range?
Kindergarten through 12th grade.
So different groups.
Right.
So let's start with that kindergarten age. What kind of activities do they do to get started on this?
So all the activities that we do in Camp Hero, kindergarten through 12th grade, are hands-on experiential. We do a little bit of talking, but mostly doing. And the curriculum was written by professionals in the protective services with the help of our Girl Scout colleagues, who are really the experts in all things girl. So the kindergartners get an introduction. For example, we approach fire attack with a wooden model, and we hook up some fire hose to a hydrant and put a nozzle on it and gate it down so there isn't a lot of pressure on the line. And we put those little girls on the nozzle, and it's really exciting for them.
Yeah, I know I saw pictures of the sixth grade group or the middle school group with the hose. I thought, aren't those things super pressurized? Don't they? Could they knock you on your butt? But they're dialed back a little.
We dial them back for the kids so it's safe.
And as they get older, are they working with real fire?
No, we decided for our camp not to do real fire, and that has to do with fit testing, masks, and SCBA and that sort of thing. So we do simulated fires. Now, with the oldest group, in contrast, the fire attack is much more involved. So they actually pull a line off of a fire truck, advance it into the fire tower, charge the line, and then bring a charge line up a set of stairs.
Wow. So that sounds tiring to me.
Yeah, it is. It's cool, though.
Yeah. So our kids, boys or girls for that matter, surprised when they see how physically demanding some of this work is.
Yes, and they're also very pleasantly surprised about how they can do it. They can pick up that bundle of hose. They can move that hose together as a team. They can handcuff the bad guy. And that's great to see. When they come to camp, they're not sure. And that's one of our goals, is to help them to find the confidence within themselves to do it.
So we've talked a little bit about the firefighting side of things. And so on the police, you mentioned handcuffing. Mm-hmm. We've got the kids handcuffing one another.
Yep.
And you, I imagine?
That's right. They learn how to clear a room. So a room that has been burglarized and has a bad guy in it, they go in with their squirt guns and take care of it. They learn how to chase down and report back when they're in a foot pursuit and those sorts of things. They even do crime scene diagramming.
Okay, and then there's the emergency medical side of things. What kind of things do they do?
We teach the oldest girls how to do patient assessment. We do spinal immobilization, which is protecting someone who has a head or a spine injury. They do splinting, controlling bleeding, and our oldest girls come out with a CPR certification as well.
And where do they do this?
In several sites around the city. Most of the time our home base is Madison College in our beautiful Human and Protective Services building. The City of Madison Fire Department, the City of Madison Police Department, as well as services around Dane County contribute. And then the girls who stay overnight stay at a Girl Scout camp that's just northwest of Madison.
So when they're getting the training, they're doing it at places that actional professionals would get their training at, the technical college or on site.
That's right. It's where the professionals train, and it's with the equipment that the professionals use.
And I understand that the girls are given a chance at some ages to live like a firefighter. What does that
entail?
That's
right. So we organize the girls into crews, as we would in a fire station. And they're assigned to bunkhouses when we go up to Girl Scout camp. They have to help cook. They have to help clean, just like we would in a fire station. And it fosters that teamwork in doing things together.
And do they get an alarm call in the middle of the night?
Well, we tried that the first year and decided against it for the last two.
You want well-rested kids
for
the training during the day. Okay. We'll do it on the last night and then send them home sleepy with the
parents. Hey, that's a great idea.
Yeah. We're talking with Captain General Mon of the Madison Fire Department. She's the founder of Camp Hero, talking about how to get girls interested in careers in the protective services, things like police work, firefighting, and emergency medical services.
And we'd like to hear from you on this. Are you a woman in this line of work? What got you interested? And who were your role models? Do you have a daughter who's interested, or would you like to get them interested? And what questions do you have about this kind of career? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@wpr.org. We're talking with Jen Roman of the Madison Fire Department about how to encourage girls to consider careers in the protective services.
We're interested in hearing your questions and your thoughts as well. Have you considered a career in policing, firefighting, or emergency medical services? Did you consider one of these jobs and then decide not to pursue it for one reason or another? And if you have kids, would you want advice on how to encourage your daughter to check out these lines of work, to think of them as girls' professions as well as boys' professions? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. So, Jen, give us a before and after. The kid shows up there and then they leave after the training. Do they talk about these jobs differently?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, our mission with Camp Hero is to help girls develop courage, character, and confidence, and we can literally see it happen during camp. My favorite time of camp is when parents pick them up and the kids get to tell their moms and their dads and their grandmas and grandpas what a great time they had and what they did. It's really great to listen to them brag about all of the things that they were able to accomplish.
And how would you encourage parents, you know, not everybody will be able to participate in Camp Hero, how would you encourage parents to talk about a line of work like firefighting to their kids, boys or girls, to get everybody considering it as an option?
Yeah, I think the key is to refer to it in a gender-neutral way. We are firefighters, not firemen. Mm-hmm. And that's true of any occupation. I think that we do ourselves a disservice when we stereotype men and women into particular gender roles and occupations.
We'll take a caller now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We have Martha in Plainfield. Martha, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm not sure how to put this, but I have a friend. She has a daughter who would be perfect for this, but I know she would be concerned about the situation in the camp. How would I put it to the mother that she would be perfectly fine and very well taken care of?
Martha, thanks for the call. So how to encourage someone to consider sending their kids to Camp Hero in the first place?
Yeah, you know, Camp Hero is probably the safest camp that you can send your kid to, as we are staffed by real firefighters, paramedics, and police officers. And we do have safety measures in place. The Girl Scouts, we follow all of their policies and procedures to keep girls and volunteers safe. We also follow all the policies and procedures of the various departments to make sure that everybody is safe and happy.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call. I want to get back to your career a little bit. Not only did you go into firefighting, you are now a captain. Once women go in, do they tend to rise through the ranks? Is that something that's changing over time?
Yeah, it's hard to tell. When you look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics, someone like me, a female in a leadership role in the fire department, is considered statistically insignificant. There aren't enough of us to even count as a percentage. So I'm unable to speak to that. I could probably make a list of the number of women in leadership roles in the United States.
So not a lot of data there because it hasn't happened much
right
yet. Is that something that I guess more women coming into the profession in the first place would raise the odds of some rising through the ranks?
Yeah, you know, I think that we're challenged by not only attracting women to firefighting, but also our hiring processes. It's no secret that in the 1970s, there were no women and they were not welcomed after Title VII into fire stations. It certainly wasn't an open arms type of situation. And bias in hiring still exists, and we're aware of that. And we're very lucky in the city of Madison that we have administration that recognizes, searches it out, and tries to make a difference in our hiring practices. And then finally, I think also retention is a big thing. You know, it's very difficult to be in a job where you feel isolated because you're the only one. And the city of Madison has done a great job of making sure that that's not the case for us.
It sounds like, though, this is going to be a long-term culture change. And I guess that brings us back around to the concept of Camp Hero. You're reaching out to people when they're young to start changing that concept over the long haul.
That's right. We're planting the seed, and it's going to take a long time to grow the tree. And, you know, that's our hope with starting with kids when they're young.
Go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Lauren on the line in Milwaukee. Lauren, hi.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm just wondering what advice you might have for females who are a little deterred by the lack of female presence in this field.
Let me just clarify, you're interested in advice that would help you progress down the road to a job in protective services?
Right, due to the lack of female presence.
I think that one of the main challenges for women in the firefighting side is to be physically prepared for the job. It is a physically demanding job, and you do have to work out and train for it. So that's the most important thing. And you can't wait until you have already applied for the job. It's a year's process to make sure that you're ready. And the other thing is that you don't have to have another female to mentor you. Certainly that is helpful. But there are very good men out there who are willing to mentor women into the protective services. You are always welcome to contact Camp Hero. We have a network of women who help other women, and we would be happy to help you as well. You can find all our contact information on our website.
Lauren, thanks a lot for the call, and good luck if you decide to pursue that profession. So Camp Hero, is this something that, do we have things like this all over the state, all over the country, or is this kind of a new groundbreaking effort?
Camp Hero is unique in itself. There are fire camps all over the United States. They tend to be for older girls and usually just an annual thing or a every other year thing. Camp Hero is unique in that it serves kids in kindergarten through 12th grade, and we cover all three protective services, so emergency medical services, police, and fire. We decided to do that very carefully because we looked at research, and the research told us that we needed to start with young kids and that we needed to give them hands-on experience and that we needed to have female role models for them. So Madison was the perfect place to do it.
How long have you been doing Camp Hero?
We just finished our third summer and have set our dates for 2015.
And was it hard to get the ball rolling when you first started out, or when you started talking to people, were they just slapping themselves in the forehead saying, why hasn't anybody done this yet?
Yeah, you know, I think what I say is that it took time for the planets to align. So I think something like this was coming down the road for a long time. But what it took was some people who could get together and have power and connections in the various entities that we needed in order to make Camp Hero roll. And that includes in Girl Scouts, in both the City of Madison Police and Fire Department and Madison College, who are kind of our key players.
And were you the one who got the ball rolling?
Yeah, well, you could say that. Some people tease me and say that I'm like a vortex, and if you stand too close, you'll get sucked in. So
has it grown over the last few years, and do you see it expanding in the future?
It has grown over the last few years. The first year, we actually filled several of our sessions, but where we see the big growth is in our high school session. The first year, we had four campers, and we actually talked about canceling it, not even doing camp, but we went ahead with it, and we're happy that we did. The second year, we had 10. Last year, we had 18 high school
campers. That's just the high school level.
That's just high school. So overall, we have a capacity for 190 campers. This year, we were in the 170 range.
Okay. So you're getting up to maximum
That's
capacity.
Right.
Do you hope to clone this and teach people how to set this up elsewhere in the state, elsewhere in the country?
Yes, we do hope that. We have a sustainability and expansion committee of volunteers who are looking at that issue. The thing about bringing Camp Hero to other places is that we need the support of the agencies that are there. And a population of women who are willing to come and volunteer. So if you're one of those places, please contact us because we'd love to talk to you about expanding into your area.
So it's less than a year before the next round of Camp Hero starts. But in the meantime, if there's a girl out there listening, a parent, a grown woman for that matter, who's thinking, yeah, why didn't I ever think of this as a career? Where are resources? Where can people learn more about pursuing careers in fire, police, emergency medical service?
So if you're interested in general, I highly recommend that you contact your local technical colleges. They have a lot of information about all three protective services. And you can also contact your local departments, police, fire, and EMS departments. We run in lots of different ways, and there's a lot of variety of ways to be involved in the protective services. Certainly Camp Hero is a resource. We have a links page on our website, and you are always welcome to contact one of us. Camp Hero does have a mentor network, that all of our campers are automatically enrolled in, and it gives them access to women who are working in the protective services for advice.
Oh, and I'd better ask you, the Camp Hero website.
Yeah, so it's Camp Hero, the number 4girls.org.
Camp Hero 4girls.org. I imagine if somebody searches Camp Hero,
you'll get
it. That's probably you that they're going to find.
Right.
All right, well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Captain Jen Roman of the Madison Fire Department. She's founder of Camp Hero. That's a summer program that encourages girls to pursue careers in protective services, things like fire, police, and emergency medical services.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's Curious Wisconsin and a look at the life, art, and mythology of salvage expert turned sculptor, Dr. Evermore.
First, we're talking about the news that broke last night that Journal Communications Incorporated of Milwaukee and E.W. Scripps Company of Cincinnati will merge their media operations.
The companies will merge their broadcast operations, which includes WTMJ's radio and television. We'll headquarter those in Cincinnati. They'll also combine their print operations into one company to be called Journal Media Group. That new publishing company will have the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel as its flagship paper, and it'll be centered in Milwaukee.
Mike Wagner is with us now to talk about this merger and what it could mean for the Milwaukee media market. He's an assistant professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So this merger just became public last night. Was this a surprise to media watchers in Milwaukee and in Wisconsin?
Well, I think it was a surprise, at least in terms of the timing of the announcement. There have been whispers in kind of the media watching community for a little while that something might be afoot. And the question was, how could these companies merge and plausibly continue to grow under different kinds of cross-ownership rules and other FCC regulations. But the way that they've done it, makes it seem as though the script side can grow with the television stations, and the new journal media group can grow with newspapers, which gives them the freedom to greatly expand their reach, both with respect to this deal, but also in the future. They're going to be able to acquire more in terms of television and newspapers, should they want to, as they move forward, assuming that this deal ends up getting ratified sometime next year.
Critics of this kind of consolidation have for a long time been worried about the effect on consumers of having a shrinking marketplace of viewpoints. Now, this is both a split and a consolidation in a way, depending on what area you're looking at, the
right.
broadcast or the print. But how do you see this affecting consumers?
Usually, consolidation results in less issue coverage for consumers and more strident tone in the coverage. And so news coverage from corporations, especially large ones, tends to be a little more in your face in terms of the tone of the coverage. And we also learn less about political issues on average than we tend to learn from privately held or local companies when they own them. So, you know, it's, of course, difficult to know what exactly will happen with these particular companies, but usually when things like this happen, it results in less information for consumers, at least with respect to learning about the kinds of political issues that those who kind of care about the underpinnings of democracy worry about getting covered a lot by the news media.
So this new newspaper group is that's going to include the Journal Sentinel is going to be called Journal Media Group. Can we
right.
talk about who's under that tent now?
A lot of newspapers. The Journal Sentinel is really the largest, and as you pointed out in the introduction, the flagship newspaper. But there are other newspapers all around the country, Wichita, and a lot of other smaller areas as well. And so they'll likely clear somewhere in the neighborhood of $500 billion. All those papers together, at least by some estimates I've looked at, whereas the television side is looking in terms of around $800 billion in terms of revenue. And the benefit on the TV side is that a lot of those are located in swing states. And so that means lots of advertising dollars in presidential election years and, you know, their fair share of advertising dollars in the midterm election years as well. And so the script side will really be making some money in terms of the advertising they're going to be able to the advertising is going to be able to charge for based on what they've acquired. And the newspapers aren't in as large of cities, but do cover, you know, a pretty vast expanse of the country. And so, you know, one in five, you know, television viewers around the country will probably be watching a Scripps station.
Now, it's interesting that the Journal side of things is going to be headquartered in Milwaukee, which is
right.
where the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel is, of course, right now. Is it good news for Milwaukee that is the decision that has been made rather than vice versa?
I imagine it is. That means there'll probably be a few more jobs in Milwaukee, and it probably makes it more likely that some of the cost savings that always occur when groups use words like synergy, as both of these groups have been using after the announcement of this decision has been made. I would expect that folks in Milwaukee, in terms of their employment and the kinds of resources and opportunities available to them, would be better off than some other places where each of these companies might have some holdings. So Cincinnati, where Scripps will be, and Milwaukee, where Journal will be, are the advantageous places to work for either of these companies.
So WTMJ will now be under the flagship of Scripps, which is in Cincinnati. In terms of content, let's look at that for a moment. Do you expect that to change now that the owners will be different?
You know, there is a place where we've seen counterintuitive findings. And so a lot of folks who study media consolidation and cross-ownership and things like that, you know, tell really negative stories about how these kinds of things really are experimenting with the underpinnings of democracy. But in terms of how these have worked in practice on the television side, has generally shown that when larger companies acquire, you know, fairly good-sized stations in fairly good-sized markets, they're acquiring the stations that do a better job of covering the news, and they tend to be stations that are more likely to air debates between candidates in election season, for example. And so there is some evidence that on the TV side, those kinds of acquisitions can help a little bit. But on the newspaper side, it tends to be the result is less informative.
Now, WTMJ is generally seen as being more conservative. Do you expect that tone to change at all now that it's part of Scripps?
There is some evidence that, just in terms of kind of media research more generally, that changes in ownership often result in the places that get acquired adopting political tones that are more like those who govern them. And so, you know, to the extent that Scripps is conservative or liberal in the kinds of political donations they make or the kinds of programs and the kind of news investigations they do on the stations they had owned in the past, we might be able to make some more informed predictions about what changes, if any, might happen at the station. But usually on the television side, if the station's doing well, the company is less likely to monkey with who the anchors are, who the reporters are, than they are on the newspaper side, where cost-cutting tends to cut more folks out of the newsroom, which makes political coverage a little more difficult to do.
Now, in our last 30 seconds here, so far those announcing the merger have been pretty rosy about the prospects, but do you have a sense of how this is going down in Milwaukee so far?
I don't have a great sense of how it's going down in Milwaukee. Investors, I think, across the board are pretty pleased, and I think people who are worried about the information provision so that they can make good decisions as citizens of Milwaukee and the surrounding area are nervous, or at least some are, and some others are probably hopeful. So we'll see. You know, the future will tell us whether this was a good decision for the citizens.
All right, Mike, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
That was Mike Wagner, assistant professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
In this week's edition of Curious Wisconsin, we check out one of the state's most distinctive works of art and most distinctive artists.
The artist is Tom Every, better known as Dr. Evermore, and the artwork is the Forevertron, a massive sprawling structure of salvaged metal.
Tom Kupsch has been following Dr. Evermore's work for years. He's the author of A Mythic Obsession, The World of Dr. Evermore. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So can you give us a brief timeline? How did Tom Every, a salvager from Brooklyn, Wisconsin, come to be the visionary artist known as Dr. Evermore?
It's a long and winding road, starting in Madison, where he was born in 1938. His folks and the whole family moved to Brooklyn, Wisconsin, shortly after he was born. Tom had a reputation even as a child for collecting odd bits of junk, things people didn't need. It got so bad that his mother actually asked him to find a place in town to put the stuff because it filled the entire yard. He did find a place, and by the time he was 14, he had collected enough scrap metal to fill a railroad car. That was the beginning of his career as a salvage person. Later on, as an adult, he founded a company that was responsible for the demolition of a tremendous number of buildings in the upper Midwest. You have to understand, at this time, there was a transition to modern architecture and modern machinery, and many of the buildings that Tom was salvaging were built in the 1800s or early 1900s, and the machinery in the buildings had become outdated. So Tom was a salvager for many years in Wisconsin, salvaging breweries, he salvaged railroad cars, power plants, industrial sites. Eventually, he came up with the idea that some of the objects that he was finding were too precious to turn into salvage. He came up with the idea that they were animated with the spirit of the person who had used them or had made them. So he set these aside and collected tons and tons over the years. Later on in the 70s, he met up with Alex Jordan, the founder and creator of House on the Rock. Mm-hmm. Their relationship lasted about 10 years. It started off with Tom selling him 2,000 whiskey barrels that he had salvaged from a distillery in Kentucky. And they moved on from there. They became quite good friends, traveling the country to attractions and to collect the odd object here and there. Eventually, Tom began to help Alex fill a tremendous room that Alex had built out at House on the Rock. It's called the Oregon Room. It's half a football field in dimension, 5.5 stories high. He started off by salvaging the steam water pumping works from Madison, which he brought out to House on the Rock and installed. That was the beginning of a mechanical fantasy that they both worked on. He followed that by installing a tremendous number of salvage items from his work throughout Wisconsin and the upper Midwest. Brew kettles from breweries who were updating or going out of business. From Gisholt Machine here in Madison, a tremendous number of motors and equipment. So they moved on through this process, through this creative process. Now, these two egos, these two tremendously creative people, worked in parallel for a while, but it was doomed. They were on a collision course, and they did collide, and it wasn't good for Tom. He went through, after he was put out of House on the Rock, he went through a period that he calls depression. Mm-hmm. And it probably was depression. It was certainly sadness. He felt that his world had ended. So many things in his personal life and his professional life had come to an end. And then one day, while he was driving his truck, he came up with a family myth in order to escape from these troubles. And the myth involved an ancestor, a fictive ancestor, who lived in the Midlands of England. Now, the Avery family really did come from the Midlands of England, so that part is true. Mm-hmm. He called this ancestor Dr. Evermore. Dr. Evermore was born to a family that was with the Presbyterian Church. His father was a Presbyterian minister, according to this myth. Mm-hmm. One day they were walking through the fields in the evening, and a tremendous storm arose. Lightning, thunder, they had to take refuge in a barn. And it lasted for quite some time. We're still in the myth here. Uh-huh. And after it was over, the young Tom, who would become Dr. Evermore, asked his father, "Where does this lightning come from?" And his father, of course, answered in a strict Presbyterian voice, "Well, it comes from Almighty God, young man." And Tom thought about this for a while and decided, well, if the lightning comes from God, if I can create a lightning force beam and get myself inside of it, I can rise to the celestial spheres. So in the myth, he begins to build the Forevertron.
The Forevertron. Now tell us, for people who haven't seen Dr. Evermore's work, can you describe the Forevertron for us?
Wow. The Forevertron is a machine that's 5.5 stories high. It's surmounted by a glass ball inside of a copper egg and surrounded by electric devices and charging machines that will create an electric force beam, electromagnetic force beam, that will cause the egg to blast off into the celestial spheres. Now, this is 5.5 stories high, mm-hmm. 160 feet long. There are a myriad of parts, and it took years to build. The reason the book is called A Mythic Obsession is because Tom took this myth, and he escaped from reality by building the Forevertron. After he came up with this myth and decided to build the Forevertron, he dedicated every moment of his life and all of his energy right to this moment to building the Forevertron and promoting it.
And around the Forevertron, on the grounds there, there are also hundreds, maybe, of his own creations, birds, elaborate birds, and really legions of different Dr. Evermore creations. Can you talk about some of those?
There are thousands of creations.
Thousands,
there.
Okay.
One of them is the bird band, in which he salvaged musical instruments that were going to be thrown away and made a bird out of each instrument, some of them standing as high as 17 feet high, that personifies or gets the spirit of the instrument. And they're arranged in a band underneath the Forevertron. And in the myth, he made them the music that would be playing when he blasts off in the Forevertron. There are other objects of art that he has created. He has principally concentrated on birds because they're a non-threatening kind of thing. But there are many, many other creations there. It's difficult to describe this. I mean, I can't.
I've seen it, and I don't know that I could either, yeah. But it's all salvaged, mostly metal, it seems like, but other materials as well. It's a precursor to what people are calling upcycling these days. He was ahead of his time in using these materials he'd found.
It's all metal. Tom works only in metal.
Only metal, I'm sorry. Okay.
Only metal. He works in semi-precious metals like brass and copper, but mostly iron. And it's all salvaged material. All of it would have gone to recycling if he had not reused it here. And many, many fascinating parts would have been lost through the years.
So with someone who's created such big things and with this mythology surrounding it, talking to Dr. Evermore, what is his personality like?
Tom's conversation flows smoothly between myth and reality and fiction and fact and the present and the future and intergalactic talk. It's difficult when you first meet him to get the feel of what's going on. But over the course of a number of years of interviews that I did with him, we developed a rapport so that I could understand the shorthand that he was using.
And what has been the international reception for the Forevertron and his other works? He's gotten international attention, right?
Yes, he has. He's well known as an alternative artist, a visionary artist. All around the world, people do come to visit the Forevertron from everywhere. And he's been, of course, published in many periodicals and books throughout the world out of great respect for his work.
There have been talks over the years of his works being moved or donated to various places. Can you talk about that, where they might end up?
There's always been a lot of talk about that because the Forevertron and the work do not sit on property that Tom owns. Mm-hmm. They're next to Delaney's Salvage, up across from the former Badger Ordnance plant. Mm-hmm. The disposition of the work finally will be in the hands of the family, of Tom and the family. That's always how it has been, and that's the way that will turn out. Whether it will be moved, we don't know right now. Time will tell.
It would take a lot to move, especially the Forevertron itself.
It would take a lot to move, but he has his son Thayer is an expert mover, following in his dad's footsteps, a very good welder, and would be able to do this task.
This is a unique Wisconsin site to go and visit the Forevertron and things like that. Do people here in Wisconsin realize what a treasure we have?
I think yes and no. I think local people, regional people do. Other people don't know where it is or what it is. And it truly is a treasure. There's nothing like this in the world.
Do Do you think that he hopes to inspire others to pursue their own unique vision? Probably not exactly his vision, the myth and the metal coming together like that. What do you think he wants other people to take from what he's doing?
Tom very much appreciates people coming out and telling him that they're inspired by the work. Oftentimes, younger artists will come out or people who are stuck. They have some sort of block in their work and tell him how inspired they are by his achievement. He finds this a great source of pride.
And for people who haven't been to visit, can you give us some encouragement to get out there and see the Forevertron?
Yes, you need to see this. The words fail anyone in describing it. There is no one who goes to the Forevertron and wanders around there who doesn't scratch their head and marvel at this wonderful work of art.
All right, Tom, thank you so much for joining us today.
That was Tom Cupps. He's author of A Mythic Obsession, The World of Dr. Evermore.